Welcome to the Ouroboros Podcast, episode number 174. I am your host, Colin, coming to you from Bath. And in this week's show, we have the start of the countdown to the biggest event in British television, or at least as far as I'm concerned. It's a little project I'll be doing over the next few weeks, which I'm rather excited about. We've also got a discussion of the new cycling season, and I apologise to everybody who doesn't care about cycling, but this week with the Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico races, the cycling season really has started in earnest. So I think it's about time we examined the stories revolving around the new cycling season and, of course, all the doping stuff that's been happening. Let's get on with the show. And it's time now for the first piece of music. This is Wire Faces with their track Helium Riders. Faces come from Fort Collins in Colorado, and that track Helium Riders comes off their debut self-titled album. Really nice slice of post-rock there, very intricately put together, and I really do like that track. And since I got that track off IODA, you can go to my website and download a free MP3 of that track. And there's quite a few tracks from this week's episode, which I got from IODA, so there's going to be an MP3 bonanza on my homepage. Now, by my reckoning, we are roughly 3 weeks away from the new series of Doctor Who starting, which is always my favourite time of year when it comes to television. So I thought, as a build-up to Doctor Who starting Series 6, I thought it'd be an interesting idea to re-evaluate Series 5. I reviewed the episodes as they came out last year, but I thought it would be interesting to see how opinions might change or differ now that the whole series has been broadcast, and with a bit of distance as well, given time for the stories and the ideas to percolate a bit. So I recently got the Series 5 box set, and over the next 3 weeks I'm going to split up Series 5 of Doctor Who and basically reevaluate all of the episodes. This week I'm going to do the first 5 episodes, then the next 4 next week, and the final 4 the week after that. And if my calculations are correct, the next week will be the start of the new series. I'm not going to give any spoiler warnings for this episode, because Series 5 of Doctor Who has been out in both Britain and America for a very long time. I think DVDs are available in both countries as well. So if you haven't seen them by now, then that's your lookout. And I'm also going to be giving ratings for each episode individually, as well as combined ratings for the 3 two-parters. And the ratings are going to be in the form of school grades, you know, A, C minus, F, whatever. So without further ado, here's my retrospective review of Series 5 of Doctor Who, starting with Episode 1, The 11th Hour. And this is everything you could possibly want for a first episode with a new showrunner and a new Doctor. It gives you a sense of the new character, but keeps enough of the old character or the old actor in the show to make it interesting. I mean, it's specifically mentioned in the episode that the Doctor is still cooking. So you do get a bit of David Tennant's Doctor in Matt Smith's performance, as well as his own interpretation of the character. And that's a brilliant way to go, because it keeps the traditions of the last actor. I mean, it's a bit silly considering that David Tennant only did it for 3 years, but for the young viewers, it keeps that continuity and also develops it into interesting ways. It's also a really good debut for Stephen Moffat as showrunner. I mean, I think one of the things that Stephen Moffat does so well is make the mundane terrifying. And in this episode, you do have the crack, and you know, the point is made that this crack must be really scary if young Amelia is unfazed by this strange man showing up. I mean, granted, throughout the rest of the series, the crack does get overused, and the explanation is a bit weak, but we'll be getting onto that in future weeks. But for a first episode, this idea of this terrifying crack in the wall is a really, really good one. This episode also has a really nice balance of the serious and the funny. Prisoner Zero is really scary, and it works well as a villain. But you've also got the very funny food scene where the doctor is trying to work out what he likes to eat, and of course ends up eating fish fingers and custard, which is ridiculous. I mean, granted, that scene does go on a little bit too long, but again, for the younger fans, that kind of playfulness with food is brilliant. I mean, there's other good stuff in this episode. The sequence on the village green, where it takes a series of still shots and just goes around this village green, that is a really, really effective scene that shows the Doctor's thought process of seeing everything around him and evaluating everything around him. Part of me would have liked to have seen that technique used again in the series, but equally, I think it's a technique that could have got overused. So in a way, I'm glad it only featured in this first episode. Good as this episode was, it was not perfect. It is flawed. In some places, quite badly flawed. The Atraxi as villains are not very threatening or scary. Having a giant eyeball look through the crack in the wall is a brilliantly effective visual. But having giant eyeballs floating in spaceships is just silly. And the resolution, the way that Prisoner Zero is discovered by the Doctor turning every computer in the planet to zero. I know that you have to suspend disbelief for a show like Doctor Who, but A, I'm not sure the Doctor could have done this in the first place, and B, how does that make the Atraxi hone in on him? It just doesn't make any sense if you think about it for more than a few minutes. So overall, this is a really good episode, a really good start to both Moffat and Smith's reigns, but it is flawed, and the ending in particular is rather silly. So I give The 11th Hour a solid B+. The next episode was episode 2, The Beast Below. And this episode highlights the reasoning behind rewatching these episodes before giving an evaluation of them. Because the first time I watched it, I absolutely hated The Beast Below. I thought it was a terrible episode. But rewatching it and having a certain amount of context for it, the flaws, while still there and still large, are not as aggravating as they were the first time I saw them. The main problem I have with The Beast Below is the Smilers, these creatures in the fortune teller type booths who turn around and have different facial expressions. They were just there to be iconic. They were there solely for the kids in the playground on Monday morning to say, "Didn't you see that on Doctor Who? That was so cool." but they didn't actually have any reason to be in the plots. They didn't actually do anything. And the ending is also deeply flawed. The idea of this space whale coming to Earth and helping Britain, when you think about it, doesn't make any sense. If the whole world has had to go into these floating space stations, then how come Britain is the only one who gets a space whale? If the space whale came to Earth and wanted to help crying children, then there are a lot more populous countries than Britain that it could have helped. And if there are other countries using these giant space stations to house their population, then surely they must have propulsion systems of their own. So why hasn't Britain used them? Why instead does it choose to torture this giant space whale and float on like nothing's happened? It's barbaric, it makes no sense. And it makes the human race out to be massively flawed, which of course they are, but in a family show, that's not really the kind of idea you want to promote. And Amy paralleling the experiences of the Doctor and the space whale, seeing crying children and not being able to help themselves from helping, that's far too easy. I mean, Amy seems to know the Doctor intimately, better than he knows himself, after only just meeting him. And I've also got a little bit of a problem with Liz Tan and her being a sympathetic figure at the head of a totalitarian state. And that was one of the things that really bothered me about it the first time I watched The Beast Below. But on this rewatch, her position in this society is a lot clearer. And I don't object to it so much as I did then, but it's still a little bit annoying. And you've got to give her a bit of a pass for the line, basically, I rule, which is possibly the best line in this whole series. So, not a good episode, deeply flawed, but not nearly as bad as when I first watched it. So for The Beast Below, I'm going to give it a C-. Episode 3 was Victory of the Daleks. And this was an episode which in the fan community got absolutely pasted. But I didn't mind it. I found it a fun romp. And the main objection to Victory of the Daleks seems to be the redesign of the Daleks. And while I didn't particularly like the redesign of the Daleks, I didn't think it was terrible. I thought it was a way for Stephen Moffat to stamp his authority on his version of the Doctor. And yes, you could follow Dave from the Inside Outcast and say these are Skittle Daleks, you know, taste the rainbow. But I honestly didn't mind the redesign. He had to do it, and the way he chose to do it was to go the exact opposite way that Russell T. Davis did. I mean, Russell T. Davis went small and monochrome. So Stephen Moffat went large and colourful. And I really didn't mind that. And another thing that seems to have annoyed the fan community is the Spitfires in space. But seriously, how can you not love that? Seeing Spitfires in space attacking a giant spaceship. How awesome is that? However, one thing that I really didn't like about this episode was using the old saw of making the robot feel emotion to stop him blowing up. I mean, how many times have we seen that type of plot device? It was silly the first time and it's still silly. And the reason for the Daleks to be apparently on the side of Winston Churchill, you know, to make the Doctor come to him and say that what is in front of him is a Dalek, that was very, very silly. But on the other hand, there were some good things in this episode. Obviously, the Jammy Dodger acting as the TARDIS's self-destruct button. That was awesome. And Matt Smith's performance at the start of the episode, you know, saying, "You are a Dalek, you are my enemy, I need to destroy you." But he was really channeling Christopher Eccleston when he first met a Dalek in Series 1. It was almost manic, and that irrational hatred and fear of the Daleks shines through in Matt Smith's performance. So that was definitely a good point of this episode. So, flawed, but a fun romp, and not nearly as bad as the fan community seems to make it. So I give Victory of the Daleks a C. Next up is The Time of Angels, which is the first part of a two-parter. And the way that River Song is introduced is so brilliant. You're making her out to be this kind of James Bond-style spy thriller kind of thing, giving her guard a psychedelic kiss. And the guard being played by The Streets for some reason, which was bizarre and unexpected. But that whole opening sequence is brilliant. And there's a lot more good ideas and scenes in this episode. I mean, the scene with the angel on the video and Amy confronting it was superb. And the dust coming out of Amy's eyes was a really good and creepy moment. And also the idea of the race of this planet being two-headed, so why have all the statues got one head? That realization and that revelation is so perfect and so perfectly placed. So there is a lot of good stuff in this episode. But this episode started the problems with the return of the Weeping Angels into Doctor Who, and that was they got retconned. And the idea of the angel on the videotape becoming an angel, and the idea of not looking at the eyes, and taking somebody's cerebral cortex so they could talk, all of that smacks of retcon. But to give Stephen Moffat credit, none of those situations really came up in Blink, which is the only time that we've seen the Weeping Angels before this. So while it smacks a little bit of retcon, it isn't a game-changing scenario. They're still the Weeping Angels from Blink, but they've got a few more twists to their nature. So overall, this episode was a great reintroduction for the Weeping Angels. And while there were one or two issues with how the Weeping Angels were portrayed, they weren't so bad that the episode itself didn't work. So for the Time of Angels, I rate it as a B minus. And episode 5 was the second part of the Weeping Angels two-parter, Flesh and Stone. And here we have a problem we'll come across again, with part 2 of a two-parter not living up to the promise of the first episode. Because in this episode, the Weeping Angels did get fully retconned. They are not the same monstrously scary creatures from Blink. What made the Weeping Angels so great in Blink was that they were not your average monsters. They didn't want to destroy the world, or they didn't want to kill people. They just wanted to take the time they had left to live. And that concept of not killing somebody and not eating somebody, but simply sending them back in time and feeding off the potential time that they had left to live, that was what made them scary, or one of the things that made the Weeping Angels so scary. But in Flesh and Stone, not only do they become that type of ravening monster who wants to kill somebody, the rules that were set up in Blink get broken. The big one is that the angels face each other. There are certain moments, particularly in the forest, where the angels can't possibly avoid but looking at each other. And let's not forget, this is how the Weeping Angels were defeated at the end of Blink. They looked at each other. But if you go back and look at the sequence in the forest, there is no way that those angels are not looking at each other. And for that matter, having massed ranks of them, they must be looking at the back of each other's heads, if nothing else. So how come they're still moving? It just doesn't make any sense. And having the angel in Amy's head and counting down, that's just silly and a total retcon from Blink. I mean, I'm making Amy, even though she is blind, walk like she can see to fool the angels. That makes no sense. If the angels can be fooled that easily, how come they're so threatening? There's no way that should have worked, and there's no way that the Doctor should have made that suggestion to Amy. It's just ludicrous. And the very end of the episode where Amy throws herself at the Doctor, that pretty much came out of nowhere. Granted, there were one or two indications in the first couple of episodes, but suddenly throwing herself at the Doctor was a little bit icky. If there had been some more build-up, if Amy had been making eyes at the Doctor consistently over the first four episodes, then I wouldn't have objected so much, but there was a moment where Amy didn't turn around when the Doctor was changing in the 11th hour. And there was another brief moment in Victory of the Daleks where she says, "Ever fancied somebody you shouldn't?" But other than that, there was nothing that built up to that. So I really could have done without it. And granted, it builds into what happens in the next few episodes, but it still was bizarrely random. I think the only really good points of Flesh and Stone were the line about the Cyber King in The Next Doctor, where the Doctor says that that's the reason why nobody remembers what happened. Because that was the only part that I didn't like of The Next Doctor, was the fact that there was no reason to have this massive Cyber King tromping all through Victorian London, and yet nobody remembers it. So Stephen Moffat cleverly corrected Russell T. Davies's mistake with one line, which I really did like. And I also kind of like the way the cliffhanger of the previous episode was resolved, with the gravity sticking them to the bottom of the spaceship. That was nice. But other than those two moments, this was a very frustrating episode, because it could have been great and it should have been great, but Stephen Moffat broke too many of his own rules and retconned the Weeping Angels far too much. So for those reasons, I give Flesh and Stone an F. So when you consider these two episodes as a whole, I gave the first one a B minus and the second one an F. So where do you put the story as a whole? And I decided to give it a D as a two-parter, because the Weeping Angels did get massively retconned. They become killing machines instead of time vampires. But there's still some really good moments in there, so I can't completely fail it, but it doesn't deserve anything more than a D as a two-parter. Okay, I've talked far too long about Doctor Who, and I think this is going to be a very long episode, as are the next two episodes where I continue doing this review. So let's get straight on with the next track. It's unlikely that any of my listeners will remember this, but about 2 years ago, I played a track by a band from Orlando, Florida, called Hugs and Kisses. Well, that was what they called themselves. Written down, it was XOXO, as you would put at the end of a postcard or something. In the intervening time, and in the build-up to Hugs and Kisses releasing their first full-length album, their lead singer, Noah Cusack, has released a debut album, and here's a track off it. Really nice slice of jangly indie pop. It comes off Noah Cusack's solo album, Momentary Lapses in the Key of W, which is a truly bizarre name for an album, but interesting music. So here is Noah Cusack with his track, When It All Went Down.
I need some answers now. Tell me what it's all about. We're all living a lie, and I've got to try to find my way out. This here's an atom bomb. I've been holding it all along. When it's set to blow, then I'll let you know. But until then, you're alright. And these little thoughts of mine, I keep singing in and out of time, hoping that cause I've got to find a way. I've been getting higher every day and chasing the sun's no longer the fun that we all used to say.
British Junely music is remarkably old. Wasp waist and swivel hippie artists and kicking out the legs, girls and boys of both types, yes, from Johnny Groats in Bonnie Scotland to the End of the Landing, are laying down fantastic old tunes all the tito, and knockers all on rotaty discus. Runny now, as light as quickening, on the surfload and into Webby, to the Made in the UK show. At madeintheukshow.co.uk. Deep joy. Here, a multipod of UK cast poodles, in excited times all bubble happy, will bring you Freeload of Chargebold, the best and most bright shiniest of all the ivory tinkles and twangy G-strings with bang 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 on the big bass drummy that this fairy island has to offer mona. Remembold, madeintheukshow.co.uk. Goodbye, load.
Thank you. A little me, a little you. Just a girl with me, the city of a little place. Know what you say, I do. A little me, a little you. Just a girl with me, the city of a little place. Know what you say,
and there's another play for Michael Gabriel, who comes from Minneapolis. That track, I Do, comes off his 3-track release, The Heart Triptych. Michael Gabriel's father used to be the manager of Prince, and his godmother is Sheila E. So he's got a bit of history in music, and I think Prince's influence in Michael Gabriel's music can be quite easily seen. So, since I spent a long time talking about Doctor Who, I'm going to spend as little time as possible talking about the new cycling season, because we've had the first relatively important one-day race, and as I'm recording, the first two big stage races are currently being contested. The first relatively important one-day race of the season is the Strade Bianche race in Tuscany. Now, for a long, long time, way back into the 19th century, one of the most important one-day races was Paris-Roubaix in the north of France. And what makes that special, and I've talked about it in the past, is lots of cobble sections. Well, Italy looked at this and saw how successful and unusual the Paris-Roubaix race was, and other cobble classics like Gent-Wevelgem, and thought, we want some of that action, what can we do? Well, they don't have cobbles in Italy, but what they do have in certain areas of Tuscany is gravel roads. So they started doing this race, the Strade Bianche. And despite only being a race for 5 years, it has become a relatively important race. And people do want to win it because it is a little bit unusual. And people who do well in the Northern Cobbled Classics tend to do well on the Strade Bianche because it's a similar type of riding, because you are not riding on tarmac roads the whole time. Well, this year it was won by Philippe Gilbert, the Belgian rider. And as I said before, he is a rider who has a chance in pretty much any one-day race you care to mention. There are different types of one-day races, and different riders do well in each of these races. You have the cobbled races like Paris-Roubaix, you have hilly races like Liège-Bastogne-Liège, you have long races which are generally suited for sprinters, like the Milan-San Remo. And each of those different types of races are going to be won by different riders. But Philippe Gilbert has a chance in any one of them you care to mention. In the last 3 years, he's won the Giro di Lombardia twice, which is a hilly classic. He's won Het Noisblad, which is a cobbled hilly classic. And he's won Paris Tour twice, which is a Sprinters Classic. And he's also won the Amstel Gold Race, which is another very hilly race. So there really is no type of one-day race where Philippe Gilbert doesn't have at least a chance of winning. And there are very, very few riders who can say that about. I think the only other one who could have a chance in all of those different races is Fabian Cancellara. So, kudos to Philippe Gilbert for now adding gravel to his type of races that he can win on. I mean, granted, this is the only race which rides over gravel, but he has a chance of winning it, and he is such an impressive rider. So the two big stage races that are going on at the moment are the Paris-Nice race and the Tirreno-Adriatico race. The Paris-Nice race is the race with a longer history and has a bit more cachet to winning it. It's generally used as a warm-up to the Northern Classics season, races like Paris-Roubaix or Liège-Bastogne-Liège. But it is a prestigious race that people want to win. We've got a couple of stages left to compete, but the current leader and the rider who's more than likely going to win the race is Tony Martin, the German rider. And he did a storming performance in the time trial yesterday. And if Fabian Cancellara wasn't riding at the moment, then you would say that Tony Martin would win every time trial out there. He is that good. And unfortunately, he's riding at exactly the same time as a time trialist who is slightly better. So Tony Martin, the German rider, won the time trial and is more than likely going to win the whole race. Although Bradley Wiggins did finish second on the time trial and is currently third in the standings. So if Bradley Wiggins really fancies it, he might have a bit of an attack on the two rather mountainous stages we've got left. Although, to be frank, it's unlikely, so Tony Martin is more than likely going to win it, and he probably deserves it, so kudos to him. And the other race that's going on at the moment is the Tirreno-Adriatico race, the race between the Tyrrhenian Sea and the Adriatic Sea, so basically going across the spine of Italy. And that one hasn't really got started yet. We haven't really had any hilly stages or mountainous stages, and they always put in at least one really difficult mountain day. So it's really not clear who's going to win that one at the moment, because the sprinter, Tyler Farrar from America, is currently leading. But as soon as it starts going uphill, he's going to drop way down the rankings. Mark Cavendish is riding in the Tirreno Adriatico and is not doing very well at all. I mean, the general rule of thumb is that people who are preparing for the Milan-San Remo race, which Mark Cavendish won 2 years ago, compete in the Tirreno Adriatico. And it's something ridiculous, like the last person who won the Milan-San Remo without competing at the Tirreno Adriatico was in something like 1979. So it is a really useful tune-up for that one-day classic. But Mark Cavendish has not been performing well at all, and I really don't think he's going to win the Milan-San Remo this year, which is a little bit disappointing. But we're going to have to see if he actually fulfills his potential and wins the Tour de France green jersey this year. So that's what's been happening on the road. But I think the more interesting thing for the non-cycling fan is all the stories about the doping and the dopers. And I suppose the biggest name in that category is Alberto Contador, who, at time of recording, appears to have got away with it. I think there are very, very few people out there now who genuinely believe that Alberto Contador ate contaminated beef, and that's what gave him his positive clenbuterol test. But somehow, he's managed to convince the Spanish anti-doping authorities that that's what happened. So at time of recording, he's been allowed to race and has already won the Tour of Murcia this year, which is a small stage race in Spain. The cycling authorities and the World Anti-Doping Agency are appealing this decision, and he will more than likely get banned, but that decision is likely only to be made just before the Tour de France starts. And Alberto Contador has already confirmed that he will be competing at the Giro d'Italia this year. So, the Spanish anti-doping authorities have really dropped the ball on this one. There was a leak that they were recommending a 1 year ban, which is a halfway house between nothing and the 2 year ban that this offence should warrant. But they didn't go with the 1 year ban. Instead, they've given him nothing. And there has been rumours and speculation that the reason that Spanish authorities haven't banned Alberto Contador is pressure from the political world of Spain, going all the way up to the Spanish Prime Minister, who has said that there's no reason why Alberto Contador should be banned. And let's not forget, it was the Spanish anti-doping authorities who let Alejandro Valverde get away with a positive test for 4 years. They really don't like banning their riders. And the UCI and WADA have to go to the Court for Arbitration for Sport to get anybody banned who's Spanish and successful and popular. It's a really messed up system, and I just want it to go away now. I mean, even if Alberto Contador did eat contaminated beef, no professional cyclist, no matter how successful or popular, deserves the benefit of the doubt. There are too many riders out there who have lied to our faces for too long, and nobody gets the benefit of the doubt. Even if he ultimately is allowed to continue racing, this will be a cloud over his head forevermore. And let's not forget, he was tangentially associated with Operation Puerto, which is the biggest and most controversial doping case in cycling history. Other stories of doping, a rather depressing one, is that Danilo De Luca is back in the peloton. Very late in the process, he signed a contract with the Russian team Katusha. Danilo De Luca is a rider who really should have had a lifetime ban by now. He served two separate bans for offences related to doping. And if you serve two bans, you should have a lifetime ban. But since the first one was not technically a ban for doping, it was a ban for associating himself with a doctor who had been convicted of doping, he technically has not served two bans for doping and has been allowed to ride again. And I really just want him to go away, because even before he served either of his bans, there was always suspicion about Danilo De Luca. And he's 35 now, so who knows what he's got left in the tank if he isn't doping. And I think it could be a sad situation for cycling. And for De Luca himself, I think he should just go away quietly. there is some good news on the doping front revolving around Ricardo Rico. Now, I've mentioned him in the past. He got kicked out of the 2008 Tour de France for doping and eventually served a ban for that. And when he came back, he signed a contract with the Dutch Vacansoleil team, which was very controversial because Vacansoleil were trying to get into the top flight of cycling teams, and the fact that they signed Rico was a mark against them. So it was controversial that he came back in the first place. And I mentioned in the past that he dumped his girlfriend and the mother of his child when she was done for doping, because he was clean and he was shocked that his girlfriend doped. So, as well as being a doper, he's a horrible, horrible human being. Well, recently, Ricardo Rico spent 2 weeks in hospital after getting an infection from giving himself a blood transfusion. And that is poetic justice of the most beautiful kind. The doper gets it wrong, gives himself an infection, and spends 2 weeks in hospital. He's now been sacked by his team, and he will more than likely serve a lifetime ban now. And all I can say is good riddance to the tosser. That's everything that's been going on in the cycling world. I probably won't do much more cycling, at least not regularly. So if you're not interested, you can still listen. But it's important to me and it's my show, so I can do whatever the hell I like. And right now what I'd like to do is play some more music. And here's another play for Degrees, who come from the tiny Swedish town of Tranås. Here's another track from their EP Part 3, which you can download for free from the net label AFMusic at af-music.be. So here is Degrees with their track Breakdown.
No, you don't need to know. request from Bud Babe's ship?
No, this.
Oh, it's the symbol for infinity, sir. The snake eating its own tail and thus completing the everlasting circle of life that has no beginning or end.
What's it doing on here?
Oh, the crate used to contain batteries, sir. Ouroboros batteries. Everlasting.
Rubber what?
Ouroboros, sir. It's the name of the symbol.
There's another piece of Swedish electronica for you. That example comes from Triobelisk, who comes from Gothenburg. And that track, Brain Traveller, is the title track of his latest album. So I'd like to take this opportunity to apologise for the extreme length of this podcast. But once I get talking about Doctor Who, it's rather difficult to get me to stop. And speaking of Doctor Who, I'd like to promote a bit of audience interaction. Since I'm re-evaluating Series 5 of Doctor Who, I'd like to get my audience's opinions. I'd like to hear from you and get your ratings for each of the episodes in Series 5. Do it in a similar way, having the school grade type rating. you know, A, B, C minus, D, F, whatever. And we'll see how much my opinions differ from those of my listeners. But remember, ideally, I'd like you to re-watch the episodes before you rate them. As has been proved by my experiences with The Beast Below, opinions can change. This rating is all about context and distance. So if you can rewatch the episodes before rating them, please do that. If you'd like to get involved, you can send your ratings to my email address, which is ouroboros.podcast@gmail.com. And once I've finished my ratings over the next few weeks, we'll have a section, hopefully, with some audience ratings as well.
Weird Trend of the Week.
The Weird Track of the Week for this week is a return to the show for Too Late, the gothic orchestral band who come from Salonika in Greece. They're working on their third album, which is apparently going to be a double album, and this is one of the tracks off it. Now, usually Too Late feature a lot of orchestral instruments like violins and cellos and things like that. But for this track, they've gone in a completely different direction. This track is completely a cappella, and yet still has that distinctive, weird sound that Too Late generally have. And regular listeners to the show will have heard a lot of Too Late tracks over the years. So, from Salonika in Greece, this is Too Late with their track, My Friends and I. See you next time, and remember, good music is infinite.
My friends and I were dead. My friends and I were dead. Or by this river, oh, my friends and I were dead. My friends and I were dead. Or by this river, oh. Down by the river alone. Down by the river alone. We drowned long ago. Down by the river alone. Down by the river alone. Drowned long ago. My friends and I were dead. My friends and I were dead. About this river. My friends and I were dead. My friends and I were dead. About this river. Living on this river alone. Living on this river alone. We died long ago. Living on this river alone. Living on this river alone. We died long ago. And I would die. My friends and I would die. The mind is river. My friends and I would die. My friends and I would die. The mind is river. Down by the river alone. Down by the river alone. We died long ago. Down by the river alone. Down by the river alone. We died long ago. My friends and I would die. I would die about this river. Oh, my friends and I would die. My friends and I would die about this river. Oh,
down by the river alone. Down by the river alone. We drowned long ago. Down by the river alone. Down by the river alone. We drowned long ago.
My friends and I, my friends and I, my friends and I.
Listening to Colin and the Ouroboros podcast. Good music is infinite.